Case number 20-1367, David Reedy versus Michael West. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Law student Ms. Bartels for the appellate.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Erin Bartels. I'm a third-year law student with the Michigan State University College of Law Civil Rights Clinic, here today on behalf of appellant David Reedy and under the supervision of my professor, Daniel Manville. At this time, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In the early morning hours of July 20th, 2016, David Reedy was in the care of the Michigan Department of Corrections when he was brutally assaulted in the middle of the night by his cellmate, Oscar Hensley. After reports of threats went unaddressed by defendant West, Hensley beat Reedy over the head with a softball-sized rock, resulting in Reedy needing transportation via helicopter to the U of M hospital, where he was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury. Approximately 20 hours before the attack, it is uncontested that Hensley and Reedy approached West in West's office, and Hensley said, quote, "If y'all don't move this motherfucker, y'all gonna be responsible for what happens." West did not ask any questions as to what Hensley meant. Rather, West stated, quote, "Hold on, you're not going to tell me who I'm moving, who I'm not moving, and that any action that you take falls on you for anything that does happen." Reedy testified that he heard West tell Hensley to, quote, "Do what you gotta do." Hensley leaned in, "Do what I gotta do," to which West replied, "Yes." Reedy testified that at this point, Hensley left and Reedy reiterated a fear for his safety to West, to which West replied, quote, "Aw, he ain't gonna do nothing. If he wants to do something, tell him to come hit me and I'll send him so far up north with so much paperwork up his." Then Reedy left. However, West claimed, and we dispute, that Reedy came back 30 minutes later and told West that he and Hensley had talked and that everything was good between the men. This fact, and the district court characterizing it as undisputed, is the crux of our case on appeal.
Can I ask you a question just about, it seems to me the hardest part for your side is the kind of standard that Farmer v. Brennan adopted. Farmer says that the defendant must both be aware of the facts from which the inference could be drawn that a substantial risk of harm exists, and he must also draw the inference. So it's that second part where I'm not even setting aside the later statement. Just assume there's a dispute of fact in the later statement, so we won't credit that. What in the record suggests that West personally drew the interest? Even the testimony you just described suggests that West told Reedy he's not going to do anything, which suggests that West personally believed that Hensley was not a substantial risk of harm because of his own statement. So what, I know you often have to rely on circumstantial evidence to prove this. What is your best circumstantial evidence that West himself, despite what he said, actually personally believed that Hensley was a risk?
Yes, Your Honor. This is based on circumstantial evidence, and it is our position that a jury could find that West saying any action that you take falls on you for anything that does happen, in addition to the statement that if Reedy wanted to do anything, that he should tell Hensley to go hit him, that this is circumstantial evidence of West acknowledging that a risk did exist, but disregarding it because he claimed that it wouldn't be his fault. Moreover, West was asked directly in his deposition whether he himself ever drew the inference that Reedy was vulnerable to assault. And West said, quote, "No, because Reedy came back and told him that everything was good." Therefore, if a fact finder found that West's testimony lacked credibility, it could certainly find for Reedy. And that's what summary judgment is all about. The district court failed to take all of Reedy's facts as true. In his deposition, Reedy testified about what occurred on July 19th when he and Hensley approached West together.
Ms. Bartels, I believe Judge Guy wants to ask a question, but he's having a trouble unmuting. There he is.
Certainly.
I was just going to say, in conjunction with what you're saying in that regard, the contact between the totality of the contract between Reedy and West was very limited. It was limited to a couple of conversations, each lasting about 60 seconds. So that's not much from which you would say that he was able to deduce enough that made him responsible for what subsequently occurred, particularly in the context of a prison environment where there's always a balancing act going on.
Sure. And Your Honor, yes, the first meeting between Reedy approaching West about, you know, being in fear for his safety did last about 60 seconds. That occurred on July 13th when Reedy approached West and said that his bunkie had threatened him. At that point, West did not make any inquiry about the threat. He did not ask any questions. And West himself testified in his deposition that he did have a duty to inquire when an inmate approaches and gives an indication that there's a likelihood that there would be an issue with his safety. Then again, this conversation of, you know,
Ms. Bartles, what was the content of that conversation? So in that first time when your client approaches West and says he feels there's a threat, did he indicate anything about the severity of the threat, what kind of threat?
And No, he did not, Your Honor. No, he did not. Judge Guy said, it was a 60-second conversation. And really, our case hinges on this July 19th conversation, in which Hensley made an unmistakable threat to Reedy's safety. Other officers were deposed in this matter about how they would have responded to a prisoner making this statement to them. And perhaps most persuasively, prison counselor Wade, who held the same position as West, said that he would have classified Hensley's statements as, quote, assaultive and predatory, and that he would have asked Hensley follow-up questions. Other officers said that they would have removed Reedy from the cell until an investigation could be completed. And West's supervisor testified that in addition to completing an investigation, he would have written Hensley a misconduct ticket. There's an MDOC policy that governs such instances when protective custody is necessary. The policy provides that whenever staff believe a general population prisoner may be in need of protection, or when a general population prisoner requests protection, the prisoner shall be placed in temporary segregation pending an investigation. It's our position that, that a fact finder could conclude that West had a duty to protect Reedy and that he also had a duty to inquire as to what Hensley meant by the threat. The district court also erred when it made credibility determinations regarding the objective component of deliberate indifference. In its analysis, the district court named 7 facts it considered when determining whether Reedy met the objective component, that the failure to protect from risk of harm was objectively sufficiently serious. However, it portrayed the facts in a light more favorable to West and disregarded facts favorable to Reedy. Full analysis of these 7 facts can be found at Appellate Record 14, pages 32 to 46, but I'll address 2 of them now. First, the district court found that the length of time between Reedy bringing his concerns for his safety to West, quote, suggested that plaintiff himself saw no imminent danger in these threats. As a reminder, just 6 days lapsed between Reedy approaching West on the 13th and Hensley's unmistakable threat on the 19th. Reedy testified that after Hensley's threat on July 19th, he again reiterated a fear for his safety to West. Additionally, there are record materials in which Reedy testified that he was concerned that Hensley might stab or assault him with a weapon. Moreover, when the Michigan State Police investigator interviewed Hensley after the attack, Hensley stated that he and Reedy, quote, both went to their prison counselor, Mike West, on separate occasions, and that he, quote, tried other avenues, but he was put in a position to do what he had to do. The district court also made a credibility determination as to the disputed reason that the men needed separating, that Reedy slammed the door. The district court wrote that this quote suggested a frivolous dispute. There is no testimony from Hensley that the disputed reason stemmed from a slamming of doors. When the Michigan State Police officer asked Hensley what the major issue was between the men, he said that it was a white-black issue. This supports other testimony in the record in which prisoners say that Hensley was a known racist in the prison population.
But didn't your own client, Reedy, in that same investigation, or at least in the officer's investigation notes, suggested that Hensley told West that it was about slamming doors? So yeah. he didn't mention that again in your client in his deposition. But that would, I think, reiterate if we have to take that fact as true, that West would not have subjectively drawn a substantial risk of threat because the underlying dispute was juvenile.
Your Honor, it is our position that the district court characterized the dispute as frivolous rather than also considering the race issues. And it is true that Reedy did, when the Michigan State Police investigator interviewed him in his hospital bed after suffering traumatic brain injury, he said that the majority of the issue between he and Hensley was a racial issue and that they'd had conversations about slamming the door.
But however, is there any evidence anywhere? So that might go to the objective factor. Is there any evidence anywhere that Reedy or Hensley told West that it was a racial issue?
There's no testimony in the record to that effect, Your Honor.
So that, I mean, we have to, at least for the subjective prong, not the objective prong, we only can consider the facts that he knew when determining whether a jury could reasonably conclude that he was actually lying or feigning, that he's not gonna harm you. And those facts, it seems to me, the only evidence is the slamming door. I don't know that there's other evidence of his knowledge on the basis for the dispute.
Your Honor, when, as I said earlier, when Hensley was interviewed by the investigator, he did say that the majority of the issue was a white-black issue, and that has been made part of the record.
I just have a quick question. I guess the time is up, but it's not really significant, but you mentioned Wade's testimony. And of course, Wade was the person who would normally be the counselor for these two. West said that he sort of recognized Reedy, but that he didn't know any Hensley or anything about him. Plus the fact that at the time Wade made that statement that what he would have done, he was a defendant in the case, Wade was. And so that statement has to be viewed with that lens.
Yes, Your Honor. And it is our position that West's argument that he was unfamiliar with both Reedy and Hensley, it's our argument that a jury could find that because of this fact, West had insufficient basis for assuming that Hensley would lie about his intention to assault Reedy.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bartles. Unless there's other questions from Judge Murphy or Judge Guy, we'll hear from Ms. Trudgeon.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Trudgeon. I am an Assistant Attorney General, and I am here today representing the defendant, appellee Michael West, who is employed by the Michigan Department of Corrections as a prison counselor. At the heart of this case is the question, what did Mr. West know? What did he know when he spoke to Mr. Reedy and his then cellmate, Mr. Hensley, on July 19th, 2016? Looking at what ended up happening to Mr. Reedy, and you know, the proffered facts of what was going on behind the scenes, it would be very easy to say this could have all been avoided if they would have just been moved cells. However, hindsight is 2020, and Mr. West did not have the benefit of knowing everything that we know now when he spoke to Mr. Reedy and Mr. Hensley on that day. So again, well, we have to ask.
Court, the district court seemed to rely heavily on the West testimony that Reedy came back a half hour later on July 19th and said everything is good. But I looked at Reedy's deposition testimony, and it seems he reiterated twice that there was no further conversation after the initial conversation with Hensley and Reedy when they both went to speak to West. So why isn't that a dispute of fact that we that very all is good comment? Why isn't there a dispute of fact on whether he made that point? Therefore, we have to assume that he did not, given the summary judgment standard of review.
Right. So I do believe that that is one factor that the court relied on, and it the district court, and they did mention it a few times in their opinion. I believe that the court, you know, used its discretion to say to accept that fact. Simply because the testimony that Reedy gave in his deposition, I believe the question was, so the entirety of your conversation happened with Mr. West happened on the 13th or 19th, please forgive me for paraphrasing a little bit. And to that, Mr. Reedy responded, yes. And the district court in their analysis of that, you know, looked at that and then looked at what West said that Reedy later came back and decided that those didn't necessarily conflict with one another. You
but
know,
the statement right before that, I'm looking just at the deposition testimony right now. Did you talk about anything else with Mr. West on that date, meaning July 19th? I think the 19th of July. Answer, no, that was it right there. I mean, that's pretty unequivocal, even with respect to the July 19th date, that there was no follow-up conversation a half hour later.
Right, and because Mr. West's deposition did happen after Mr. Reedy's, you know, there was no way for us to follow up with Mr. Reedy to specifically ask about that statement, about, you know, if he did come back. Because he could have very well forgotten during the deposition. And the fact that Mr. West testified that Reedy had come back and made that statement during his deposition, you know, defendants used that statement both in the motion for summary judgment and in our objections. And not one time did Reedy come back and say, I didn't say that.
But does that make it not a disputed question of fact? I mean, you say, well, I didn't have the chance to follow up. Isn't that what cross-examination's for? So I wonder if you're making your case for trial, which isn't, I don't think, what you want to do.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. That's not what I'm trying to do. I guess what I'm trying to do is explain why the district court chose to accept that fact is true, rather than as appellants asked in their brief to have an opportunity to address that fact, which I think is, you know, the first option under Federal Civil Procedure 56E.
Well, I mean, your case is a lot stronger for summary judgment if that fact is accepted as true. But do you think your case hinges on that statement?
I do not. Looking at the district court's opinion, you know, it relied on many different facts. I believe they list, you know, seven facts that they used for finding that Mr. West was not objectively deliberately indifferent, and then several as well for why he was not subjectively deliberately indifferent. And I definitely believe that subjective standard is where we win on summary judgment. Just looking at what West knew when he spoke with Reedy and Hensley, you know, we've heard from appellants that it was a race issue. That was never brought to West's attention, and I think the record is very clear on that. You know, what he did know is these two grown men came to him together to request a cell change. You know, not once did Reedy indicate that he was fearful for his safety. You know, they simply requested to move cells, which West is a, you know, veteran MDOC employee. You know, he's heard lots of different reasons for why people want to move cells, and he's not just gonna move cells because someone asked. There has to be a reason. And when he spoke to Hensley and Reedy on that day, he clearly did not draw the conclusion that anything was going on behind the scenes that would warrant a cell change due to Reedy being at risk of his safety.
But what about opposing counsel suggests, as is often the case in these types of cases where intent is the key question, that circumstantial evidence has to be used. How would you respond to whether there's enough circumstantial evidence here that he may have actually actually known of the risk and just didn't care, including like the comment about, well, he can come attack me.
Right. And I don't believe that the circumstantial evidence is enough. As we can see, you know, the comment about, you know, you're going to be responsible for what happens that Hensley made to West, that triggered the further conversation of West saying, you know, hang on, you know, you guys, how old are you guys? You're both adults. You know, as Reedy told the police when they did their investigation, he had overheard Hensley say the dispute was about how Reedy slammed the door. So, you know, you guys are both adults. You can handle this. This isn't that big of a deal. That really shows that, you know, he didn't think it was serious at all.
Well, can I, if you'd like, I'd switch gears briefly about qualified immunity. You only had a paragraph in your brief about qualified immunity. I would have generally thought that the qualified immunity test asks whether there's analogous case law that would have put Mr. West on notice that in these facts, he had a duty to do more. But you don't seem to make that argument. You're instead making kind of a general argument that doesn't really distinguish qualified immunity from the underlying merits of the dispute. And I'm wondering, does that mean that you concede that qualified immunity is satisfied automatically if we find that there's a genuine issue of material fact on the objective and subjective prongs of the Eighth Amendment claim?
Not necessarily. I realize that the qualified immunity argument wasn't really brought into our appellant briefs, mostly just because that's based on, you know, what was in the appellant's brief. And that was focused on, you know, just this summary judgment standard. I was brought in later on the district court case, so I'm not super familiar with, you know, why they chose to go the route that they did. But that is something, you know, if we were to, I guess, fail on summary judgment at this point, we would look into that further prior to trial.
But you did assert a qualified immunity defense you did raise it in the district court. I mean, it's yours to raise,
right?
But you did raise it, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so do you think we could sustain the judgment on those grounds or we're not?
I'm not sure I understand your question, sorry.
You raise the defense, you haven't done much to brief it in this court. The district court didn't rule on those grounds. Can we rule on those grounds? Because I haven't seen a case that is sufficiently analogous, I don't think, to deny the defense of qualified immunity to your client, but that's not really the position this litigation has gone, the direction.
Right. Okay, yeah. So I do believe that our qualified immunity argument was solely based on the fact that he wasn't deliberately indifferent. And so at this point, you know, that if anything further than that hasn't been briefed or, you know, an opinion either way by the lower court. So I wouldn't think that would be properly before this court at this time.
All right. Ms. Trudgeon, do you have 3 minutes remaining? Do you have anything else you'd like to say to the court? I'm not sure whether my panelists have other questions. Judge Guy, Judge Murphy?
One thing I think that we haven't really touched on that at least I took as kind of a big point in appellant's brief was this theory that the court incorrectly accepted as true the fact that Reedy came back, and they did. I know we talked about it generally. I guess I just wanted to state that, you know, under Federal Civil Procedure 56E, that is an option available to them, and it's a discretionary option. And I think the court, you know, clearly lays out in its opinion, the district court clearly laid out in its opinion why it chose to go that way and accept that fact is true. I, you know, do not believe under any circumstances the court made an error in doing that and should have given appellants, plaintiff, another opportunity to specifically address that fact, as I believe appellants suggest in their brief. I don't think there was any abuse of discretion there. And, but other than that, I would just like to say that, you know, the record evidence shows that Mr. West was not objectively or subjectively deliberately indifferent to Reedy's safety. You know, at any point during, at any time, Reedy could have come back to West on his own and, you know, verbalized his concern for his safety, and you know that would have triggered some kind of protection interview, possibly likely being put into temporary segregation. But because Mr. West did not believe that Reedy's safety was at risk, that did not happen, and there was, you know, nothing to him to subjectively indicate that there was an issue between the two. And also objectively, you know, they lived in harmony together for 3 or 4 months. Neither of them, or Mr. Reedy, was not, you know, inherently vulnerable inmate. He was familiar with the prison system. He'd been in and out of prison since, I believe, 92. Hensley and Reedy were roughly the same age. So we would just ask that this court find that the district court was correct in granting Mr. West's motion for summary judgment.
All right, thank you, Ms. Trudgeon. Ms. Bartles, do you have rebuttal for us?
Yes, Your Honor, just a couple of points that I would like to reiterate for the court. Appellee pointed out that it is her position that Reedy never reiterated a fear for his safety, but taking Reedy's facts is true. On July 19th, after Hensley's threat, he did reiterate a fear for his safety to West, which went unaddressed. Secondly, the 56E issue, the district court said that it used its discretion because plaintiff failed to raise this issue in its response motion. But I would just point this court to ECF 62, pages 480 and 481. And that is our response to defendant's motion for summary judgment. And I'd like to just read a portion of it here for you. Plaintiff outlined what occurred between he and Hensley when he and Hensley approached West on July 19th. plaintiff stated that, quote, these statements create a genuine issue of material fact, and it is a question for the jury. West's state of mind turns completely on the context and nature of this conversation. Reedy states he made a plea for help, while West claims that Reedy quelled any risk of harm and came back to state everything was good. It is our position that we explicitly pointed out that this was a genuine dispute in our response to a defendant's motion for summary judgment. And therefore, the district court using its discretion under 56E2 was an abuse of discretion, because he could have used, if it felt that this fact was improperly addressed, it could have given plaintiff an opportunity under 56E1 to properly support or address the fact.
Does it matter? I think that portion of your brief was in the qualified immunity section after you had already talked about the merits. Do you think that matters at all, that the district court could have said somehow thought that was just going to qualified immunity rather than going to the merits of the subject element of the Eighth Amendment claim?
Yeah, respectfully, Your Honor, it was in the qualified immunity portion of the brief, but it was in the brief. And the magistrate judge, in her report and recommendation, had no issue finding that Reedy failed to properly or support or address the fact. The report clearly stated that there existed genuine issues of a disputed fact. And the magistrate also stated that it could not rely on West's testimony that Reedy came back and told him everything was good to grant summary judgment, because the role of the court is to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Reedy. Thank you, Your Honors. I see that I am out of time, but I would respectfully ask that this honorable court remand to the district court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both our counsel, but I guess one of you is not quite yet counsel. We appreciate the arguments on both sides, and we'll take the matter under consideration.